Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Jordan Jarrett-Bryan of Channel 4 News, and Dominic Fifield of The Athletic. You know the script. History beckons. A nation expects. You'll hear a lot about 55 years of hurt in the build-up to Sunday's European Championship final. Such theatrical nostalgia only cheapens the occasion. 1966 belongs to a different world, another generation. This is about the now and the new. Gareth Southgate is the sort of leader this country lacks, ruthless when required, but naturally compassionate. He's fashioned an England team, actually make that an England squad, of which to be proud. Italy will be favourites at Wembley on Sunday night. But Jordan, that tells us only a fraction of the story, doesn't it?
It really does. And I'm not sure. I think it's a 50-50 game. I understand why people would have Italy as favourites. I think there's a lot of things going in England's favour as well in this game. I mean, first of all, I was there last night. I was there till 1 a.m. and it was just another level, guys. It was tiring. It was raucous. It was beer infused. We got droused in bit cheap beer at that as well. But it was amazing. There was no trouble. The fans were just pouring out onto Wembley Way. You know, it took us an hour to get down Wembley Way into the tube station. But it was all worth it. It was really, really good. And I think that part of the story here is, yes, England are in a final on Sunday, which is fully deserved. But I think what is really interesting, which I've taken away from this tournament, is Gareth Southgate. And I'll get to Sterling maybe a little bit later in the pod, but start with Southgate. I think what Gareth Southgate has done is phenomenal, because what Gareth Southgate has managed to do in 4 or 5 years is change the perception of the England team from one that was much of an embarrassment to the nation, one which people, I think, hoped might go to the quarterfinals, maybe a semi-final at best, beat a big team on the way, to one actually now where the expectation is that if we don't get to the latter parts of competitions, it's seen as a failure. And that, I think, is a good thing. I think Southgate has got the England team now having the country believe that they can now, at the bare minimum, get deep into competitions. And I think that is a phenomenal achievement. We're no longer laughing at England getting knocked out in the early parts. We're now expecting. I was there all day yesterday, and the talk amongst the fans, guys, was, well, actually, no, this is the prelude to Sunday. We expect to get to the final rather than, oh, it might happen, great day out, we'll see how it goes. And the other final thing I would say as well is that we're also at a point where if Sunday doesn't go to plan and worst case, England lose that final, there's no longer a thought of it's a once in a generation opportunity. If England were to lose on Sunday, you don't feel like they'll never get there again. Southgate's got the country believing that if they were to lose on Sunday, don't worry. We're a semi-final team now. We will get to the latter parts. And that, for me, has been one of the biggest takeaways. The perception of how people see the England team has massively changed.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, that's down probably to Gareth Southgate's human touch, you know, above everything else. Dom, you know, the nation, if not the squad, is at this sort of intersection between excitement, expectation, and let's be honest, a bit of entitlement. Will Gareth Southgate's biggest job be insulating his players from the hysteria that, you know, Jordan was talking about there, and will obviously build until Sunday night.
Well, certainly one of his jobs, definitely. I mean, I do think we shouldn't underestimate just how cocooned they are in St George's Park. I mean, that is in the middle of nowhere. It's not as if they're, you know, in the middle of a city centre that's going wild every night in anticipation of Sunday. That they can escape. They're in their own little world there, and that will help them. But they'll also want to be a part of it a bit, because I think in Russia in 2018, Fabian Delph went back for the birth of one of his children during the tournament. He was the only member of that squad that experienced the hysteria, the gleeful hysteria that was erupting in England. I mean, I didn't experience it because I was in Rapinha with England as well. But he sort of came back and told them all, the nation has gone mad here. They're unbelievably behind you. They're thrilled at your progress. And I think a few that opened their eyes to a few of those guys, a few of the younger guys in particular, of the impact, the progression and the success of the England team can have. So they'll want to experience a bit of that. They'll want to be a part of it. They'll want, certainly when they come and stay in, I don't know whether it's the Grove or whether they go back to Maida Vale on Saturday night, they'll want to feel as if this is an event that they're taking part in and that they're participating in, because that will add to the... That will get their juices flowing. That will add to the anticipation. That will focus their minds, I think. I don't worry about this team mentally. I think they passed a massive, massive test on that front last night, in that they concede a goal, their first goal of the tournament. They go behind. And all that preparation that Southgate had put in, and bear in mind that he's exceptional in this point. Managers don't normally do this. I mean, a mutual friend of ours, Mike, Drew Broughton, who now classes himself as a fear coach, was talking to me about this. I mean, the idea that you sort of exercise your worst fears together as a group before they happen, in anticipation of how you will react when there is a setback. And Southgate had asked his squad, how are we going to react if we fall behind in a game? He'd asked them pre-tournament. He asked them way back in his tenure as well. And there was this look of horror on their faces when that subject was first breached. But actually... It's worked. They sort of explained it to each other, how they would react, how they would stay calm, how they would focus again. And last night was a case in point. It took them 8 minutes to create that first amazing chance and Kasper Schmeichel save from Raheem Sterling after conceding the opening goal. And within 60 seconds of that, they were level through the own goal. And then dominated for what remained of that first half and for large periods in the second half and extra time as well. And that just shows the strength of character, the strength of the fortitude of this team mentally. And I think that stands them in hugely good stead for Sunday.
And just to build on Dom's point there, I think we as the media have really overinflated this narrative of the pressure of the past on this team. It's been said by some as well. Some of these guys weren't even born for some of these traumas. I think that's massively helped this England team, that the fact that they're not weighed down by 96, 90 and all these previous failures, because they weren't here. And I think that we're seeing an England team now that are like, what are you guys talking about? We don't quite understand why you guys are so tense and nervous. We're a good team. We've got a chance. I don't understand. I think that's massively helped, the fact that it's a new generation of players that are not tainted by traumas of the past in the way that the Lampard, Gerrard, Beckham, previous teams definitely have been.
Yeah, I think that is an absolutely fundamental point, you know, because, you know, it's interesting, you know, tabloid front pages especially seem to be still in that, you know, swinging 60s era in terms of their attitudes and everything else. 66 is a great milestone, but it's not relevant. And as I said in the intro, Dom, this is about the now and the new. And this team, let's face it, are probably ahead of schedule, aren't they?
Well, that clock in St George's Park that's ticking down towards Qatar 2022 would suggest they're slightly ahead of schedule. I don't think we should. I mean, we can talk about 66, obviously, and how, you know, that means nothing to them. 96 means nothing to these guys. I think 2010, 2014, 2016 do mean things to these guys. They remember how disappointed the nation was at those exits.
Iceland was the reference point,
Iceland,
there, wasn't it?
Oh, I mean, Iceland and Nice was horrific. And, you can still hear that thunderclap, the Icelandic thunderclap post-match, and it makes you shudder. I mean, what a horrific night that was. At least that was a specific evening, a specific event. I mean, 2014 was just an entire non-event for the England football team in Brazil. They went out within a week of the tournament starting. So those memories will be fresh, even amongst the youngest members of this team, with the possible exception of Jude Bellingham. But so they are sort of bouncing back from that. But yeah, they're creating their own history. They're writing their own stories. And I think when Raheem Sterling or Harry Kane sits this group down, and he will have done, and speaks to them about Iceland in 2016, or Jordan Henderson talks to them about what happened in 2014, I think a few of them will just wonder themselves at the transformation of the fortunes of the national side. And so much of that can be pinned on Gareth Southgate and everything he's done.
Let's look, Jordan, if we could, at the nature of that squad. There are no appreciable egos. They're not consumed, it seems, by, you know, this superstar culture. You know, we've been around, Dom, especially, haven't we, when we've been around England players, which are basically a disparate collection of alpha males. What we've got now, I thought, was summed up, and it was a line that Migs Delaney came out with today, where he talked about Southgate after the game trying to explain his decision to take Grealish off to Grealish himself. And the response he got was, and I quote, "Gaffer, I'm not bothered. We're in the final." Now, when you get a professional athlete talking like that, it means that, you know, there's been a whole culture shift, isn't there?
100%. And you use that word there, egos. There are no egos here. Everybody's bought into what Southgate is trying to do. There's no circus. There's no scandal. There's no star. Who is the... I mean, Sterling will probably stand out as the tournament's best performer, I think, if he has a good final, and definitely for England. But even by previous England team standards, Sterling isn't a star. He's not a Beckham. He's not a Rooney. You know, he's not a Lineker or a Gascoigne. He's just the best player, one of the best players in the team. And I think that has definitely contributed to focusing the England team on what they need to do. We want to win a major tournament. We have the talent to do it. We have home advantage. We have the fan advantage. Everything is going in our favour. Let's not get involved in any of the nonsense on the outside. Let's for one month, focus on doing the best that we can do. And I think dropping egos and someone like Grealish saying what he said there, I think is telling. He doesn't care. And I think there's also this idea that people, I came around to it pre-tournament, but this idea a lot of England fans have come around to now, they don't care how we play. We don't care if we play well. We don't care if it's exciting. Just win the game. And I think every single player is now buying into that philosophy. As long as we win the game, that is the most important thing. It's not about me. It's not about you. It's not about who gets the headlines. It's about us winning the next game. And the next game is a big one. And I don't think, to broaden it just for a second, beyond football, we should underestimate, if England were to win on Sunday, how big that is. That, for me, is bigger than Mo Farah being double Olympic gold at the Olympics, Murray winning Wimbledon, Hamilton seven times F1 champion, England winning the Rugby and Cricket World Cup. This would be the greatest British sporting moment since 1966. And I think that when you look at the players, you don't get a sense that they are bothered by that extra pressure. But I think it's important to note that this is not just another interesting and progressive sporting moment in this country's history. I think it would be the biggest since 1966.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of strength to that argument, Jordan. And also, you know, I hope that actually the media are a bit more mature about it as well. You know, I think, you know, we have not a duty, because that inflates the role of the media, but there is, you know, we don't need the, you know, what we need is actually the real stories to be told. Now, in that sense, you know, and you looked at Jordan, you talked about the wider context. You know, Dom, let's look at Raheem Sterling, if we could. He has been almost a force of his personality has emerged during the tournament. But what about his backstory? What does that tell us about, you know, the nature of some of these players, where they came from, why they cherish the ambitions and the chances that they've got? You know, here's someone who was taken to training by his sister on three buses when his mum, a single mum who brought up four kids, cleaned offices. Now, if that isn't a morality play for our times, I don't know what is.
Yeah, his backstory is remarkable. But I think a lot of those guys have got very humble backstories as well. A lot of them, are, we've mentioned before, are grounded in the football league. They're grounded in lower league clubs. There was a brilliant the reality that both goalkeepers in last night's game, Kasper Schmeichel and Jordan Pickford, made their professional debuts at Darlington in the non-league. I mean, I think that's prevalent throughout the England squad and definitely plays a part in the way that they react, the way that they perceive themselves, but also the way they are perceived from the outside. And it's formed them all. And maybe that was maybe you could argue that going back to golden generations, etc., and even before that, there were a lot of occasions where those players weren't from. They were quite privileged in terms of how they'd been brought up and the systems and the clubs that they played for. These guys have almost seen football at the coalface throughout their junior careers. It may not be the case in the future either. I mean, ECPP and academies, etc., we may get a different kind of footballer, a more polished kind of footballer, a sort of youth system generated footballer that has grown up in pristine Premier League elite academies in future years. But from this lot, when you look down that squad from look at Tyrone Mings's background. I mean, look, they've all got these stories. They've all got them. Jordan Henderson as well. I mean, it's just, I think it's brilliant, and it definitely makes them all-rounded characters and probably plays a part in how they are coping and how they're being received through this successful time.
I'm so enthralled by Raheem Sterling, and I totally agree with Dom that I think half the squad at least have really interesting backstories. But I'm going to Wembley today to meet some of his friends to do a piece on his background. And my job today is to try and find a new angle on it, because it's been told so many times. I've got to try and find a different way of telling that story. But the reason why I'm fascinated by Raheem Sterling is because I've heard of the praise for his performances, and rightfully so, during this tournament. And I've heard like, oh, he is world-class after all. I mean, without getting into the whole world-class debate, because it's a rabbit hole, I don't personally think he's world-class. But I think what he's shown in this tournament is, in the moments that matter, he will step up. I don't think he's been... The first two games where he scored the first two goals, I didn't think he was brilliant in those two games. I thought he was good. I didn't think he was brilliant, but he scored the goals that mattered. Yesterday, I thought he was brilliant. I thought he was beating players. His fitness levels in extra time were absolutely off the scale. I have no idea how he found the energy to run as he did. But I think what's fascinating about him, he did an interview with Gabriel Clark, a phenomenal interview for ITV, which I thought was so good, talking about the perception of him through the media. And, you know, he said something really pertinent about what's changed for him is that he cares less about what people think about him. He's learned to care less about what we have to say about him. And that has enabled him to be the player he's being at this tournament. He's not had a great season, but when you compare him to other players in his position in the Premier League, he's not had an awful season, but the standards he's set are so high, when he drops below them just a little bit, we perceive it as a poor season. I think that the perception of Raheem Sterling off the field needs to change. But what's important for me is that he's saying he doesn't care either way. I'm going to be who I am. I know who I am. I'm comfortable in who I am. And that is enabling me to become a better footballer for the nation. Now go and write your blogs.
Not bad, not bad. I tell you what, the thing that strikes me, and we've got to be up front here, and we've got to grasp a nettle, a bad stinging nettle.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Yeah. By common consent, Sterling won that penalty last night. Does that mean that England can't occupy the moral high ground if, or more probably when, the Italians indulge their talent for subterfuge and cynicism? What do you think, Dom? I'm sorry, it's a hospital pass.
I thought there was contact. I thought that that the actual controversy around that penalty was that Sterling rang past another ball that was on the pitch in the build-up. But he wasn't... I mean, that ball was close to him. It was within 5 yards. It must have been in the eye line of the defenders that were tracking him. And I was amazed that the Danish substitute's appeals to the assistant linesman were waved away. When there's a ball on the pitch. I mean, look, I don't know who threw it on there, but that, to me, was astonishing. The pace that Sterling was running into that penalty area, and I don't think the foul was given against Mailer either. I think it was given against Jensen for coming across, and there is contact between Jensen's first with his arm and then his thigh to Sterling's thigh. So he goes down. England could argue that Harry Kane should have had a penalty earlier in the half when Nordgaard, the Brentford defender, was clattered him. They could also argue that the free kick that Denmark actually scored their goal from was soft. But quite frankly, I could not care less. It was given. And we all know the rules. If the on-field referee gives that rule, then it's got to be a blatant error that the VAR can pick up on it. And it wasn't. It wasn't clear and obvious. So the penalty was given. Yeah, we all know what to expect on Sunday. But then it would be hypocritical of me to suggest that England... I mean, I remember so many tournaments going over the years from South Africa in 2010 onwards. There would always be a one sit-down session with Wayne Rooney at all these tournaments. He would be wheeled out to the daily newspapers and we'd sit there with him. And inevitably, second or third question would fly in there. Do England need to be more streetwise? Do England need to be more cynical? Do England need to start winning penalties and winning free kicks and taking timeout game, managing games? And Wayne Rooney would always buy into it and say, yeah, of course we do. We're not streetwise enough. Well, we are streetwise now. So live with it.
Okay, so first of all, it's 100% not a penalty. I'm going to disagree with Dom for the first time here. There's no way it's a penalty. There's contact for sure. It's not a foul. But where I do agree with Dom, I couldn't care less. I couldn't care less because those are the breaks you get. I've always been a big believer. One of my favourite phrases or sayings in life is, and I genuinely believe it, the hardest working people in life are the luckiest people in life. I think if you look at teams, individuals who get the breaks, it's because they've generally done the work. England are one of the two best teams at these Euros and they're in the final. There was, as also Dom says, Kane should have had a penalty earlier in the game. So they got the breaks. Lampard, 2010 in Germany, as you mentioned. Maradona, come on. I have no problem normally piling in on England because they're normally awful and they deserve to lose and it's been an embarrassment for many years. But I'm going to stick up for England here because England, I don't think, have been very good at the dark arts. And a colleague of mine at TalkSport, Jason Cundy, has been saying for years, and I agree with him, he has no problem with players cheating. If you get caught, deal with the consequences. If you can get away with it, get away with it. The Italians, the Spanish, the Uruguayans, the Argentinians, the Brazilians, they all do it. They all do it. If you get caught, book them. If you get away with it, it's your penalty. So I don't have a problem with it at all. I thought Sterling earned the penalty over the course of the game and the tournament, and England got the break. And over the course of the game, I thought England were the better team. So for me, it's not a penalty. It is not a penalty, but I couldn't give a damn.
Yeah, well, let's have it right. You know, England deserved to win. I think it was interesting the manner of which they closed out that win, Dom. Right? That sense of self-control, you know, they kept possession. I saw a stat this morning. They completed 52 passes without Denmark touching the ball in the last 2 minutes and 41 seconds of the game. Now, that's brilliant composure under pressure, isn't it? And it's something that we don't associate with England teams.
No, we should start to associate it with England teams. There was a sense of control about last night. It was, my mind went back to the Luzhniki in 2018, and it was that game in reverse in many ways. Not an early free kick for Denmark, but a free kick to open the scoring. It was England back in 2018. It was Denmark last night. But then that dominance eroded steadily, gradually, inexorably by Croatia back then, a Croatia team brilliantly orchestrated by Luka Modric. England didn't have a Modric, they had control. and they imposed themselves, and the way that they recovered from going a goal down, as we said in the first section, was outstanding, and the control they had throughout the second half. Denmark were tiring. Denmark looked exhausted. The last 10 minutes of the game, they were wheezing. They were wilting.
They were done.
Yeah, they were absolutely gassed. And it was England who were going to score the next goal. I thought, fair play to Denmark for the way that they attempted to rally in the second period of extra time. There was a period where they sort of heaved themselves back into the contest, and they did try and unsettle England, but the way that England closed it out for the last 5 minutes was outstanding and really just indicative of the dominance that they'd had for long periods of that game. They're comfortable in possession. They are calm. Southgate is a calm manager now. I don't think he always was. I don't think he was in 2018. Some of his decisions at the Luzhniki were naive, but he's learned lessons from that. This group have learned lessons from that. And that's also a sign of a good team, developing team. And they were the dominant force. And, my timeline was littered last night and this morning with people saying that England is still saying that England are dull and England are boring and that Southgate is they're doing this in spite of Southgate. I don't know where these people are coming from, other than they're aggrieved and they're not English. Throughout this tournament, with the possible exception of periods of the Scotland game, England have been in control.
Can I just add to that very briefly? Maybe it says a lot about me and how boring I am as a person, but I found that closing out period, as you put it, Mike, the most fascinating and most pertinent part of England's Euros, because it said to me that, as Dom says, they've learned how to see out a game. They recognise that Denmark were done. They couldn't press. They couldn't even get to England to foul them. That's how knackered they were. And England just thought, we haven't got a score. That sequence of passing was just so good. They were calm. Apart from a 15-minute period in the Denmark game last night, I can't think of a time where I've been tense or nervous or felt England were not in control of the game. And that just composure to see the game out and not, I was screaming, get the third, kill the game, kill the game. But they didn't even need the third. The substituting of Jack Grealish, I thought, was an error. Well, it wasn't because they won the game. But I thought that was an error, because that's the one person who, A, can keep the ball and win you fouls. So I found that one slightly bizarre, taking off Jack Grealish. But I think the word that Dom uses, control, that the team had the control. And I think that was something that I was really like, it really gave me a buzz to just see that this England team, there's not going to be any last minute, oh, they're going to equalise. It was England have got this. Denmark recognised. And I thought it was telling as well that Schmeichel didn't even come up. I think they had a corner quite late on. He didn't even come up, because I think even he realised psychologically, this is over. We're done. And I think that is a testament to England. And again, so super briefly on Southgate, because I think Dom made another good point about people who are still hating on Gareth Southgate. I think those people, Dom, are never going to change their minds on Southgate. No. And I think there's a perception of Southgate that the way he looks, the way he walks and carries himself, the things he talks about, I think there's a group of English fans that feel like he's not one of us. He doesn't feel English like us. He doesn't feel it like we do. And no matter what he does, even if he wins on Sunday, there'll always be a group of people that will find something to beat him over the stick with. Because I think it's not about football. I think there's some people that don't like him. He's not a Venables. He's not a Keegan. He's not even a Hoddle. I think there's something about him that I think a group of English fans feel, nah, we're not having him. So no matter what he does, those group of English fans are never going to really warm to him.
I agree with you on that. And I'm not saying that some of those criticisms were, you know, they're probably delivered by fans who weren't English as well. And they probably look at him as a bit slightly geeky. And I think he probably admits he's probably quite slightly geeky as well and doesn't care at all. I'm going to disagree with you, Jordan, for the first time. I thought the substitution...
Let's have it. Go on.
The substitution of Jack Grealish was brilliant and a sign of how far Southgate has come along. There is no way in 2018 that he would have substituted the substitute. There is no way in 2018 he would have changed the team's shape to preserve a lead. There's absolutely no chance. And the fact that he saw that as an opportunity to bring on Trippier and to go three at the back and to match up basically against an opponent that was knackered. And the only way I think that Denmark were ever going to get back into that game was to exploit space that, playing against a different system might have opened up. by matching up, that space was closed down and, fair, and the Danes were beaten.
Does that also, Dom, though, point or highlight the very quiet influence of Steve Holland on this squad? It's very interesting. You know, he's very quick to approach Gareth at key moments. My gut feel was that was a decision made by, or suggested at least by, Steve Holland. You saw him at Chelsea quite a lot. Give us an idea, an insight into him.
Well, he's not quiet for a start. I think in this relationship, he's the bad cop. I think if you ask those England players privately about training at St George's Park and in this tournament, he's the one that's whipping them into shape on the training ground, admittedly with plans that are drawn up and discussed with Southgate. But Southgate's the man manager and Holland is the... Well, he's driving them and he's the one who's setting the standards and he's the one that's calling them out, even the senior players, if those standards ever slip, even slightly. So I don't think he's a silent partner in any respects. I think he's probably the most vocal voice on that training ground. But I agree with you on, I suspect that, yeah, that he will definitely have had a say in that. But it would have been a plan. This would have been meticulously planned, like everything is with this England team. If we go 2-1 up in extra time, we will change the system. We will do this. I mean, the only person who probably was surprised was Jack Grealish, I imagine. Well, I suppose, and everybody else in the stadium who wasn't involved with the England side. But I thought that was brilliant improvisation from the outside looking in, but actually probably really meticulously thought out. This is the way we close this game down. And just going back to 2018, there is no way that would happen. You know what? It wouldn't have happened in 2019 at the Nations Cup either, Nations League, when England were made to look naive by quite a young Dutch team. They're shrewd, they're canny, and they're streetwise. In the same way that, you know, that we're talking about Sterling and the penalty, England know how to manage games now, and they're doing that from the bench and out on the pitch.
When you think about it, one of the things that strike me about this squad is the range of options that Southgate has in terms of his selection. And we've also almost got that. It's almost like a baseball thing where you have certain players for certain situations. What we've got probably, Sterling and Kane up front are, they're set in stone. On that left side, Jordan, who would you play on Sunday? Bukayo Saka, we've got Foden, we've got Grealish, we've got Sancho, unbelievable riches. Where would you go? Where would you jump?
It's a good question. So looking at the Italian team and how I think they might set up, I think it's a question of, do we penetrate them with guile or pace? Or directness, because I think you get the guile from Foden. I think you get the pace from Saka, but you get the directness, I think, from Sancho. I would probably lean towards sticking with Saka. I think he's doing a really good job of occupying that particular fullback or that the defender, whoever's in that pocket, for an hour. He's fading after an hour quite badly, but that's fine. He's young and he'll get there. But I think for an hour, he's really working that pocket of that team's defense. So I would lean more towards Saka. I think Foden has had moments, and I think I think his time will come. I think this might be a tournament too early for him in terms of the expectations that a lot of people put on him. But I think Saka's the one. And Sancho, I thought his performance against Ukraine by people was slightly inflated. I thought he was good. I thought Sancho was good. I didn't think he was as good as everyone made out to be. And I'm a Sancho fan. He literally grew up about 30 seconds from where I am now in Kennington. So, we all love Sancho around here. but I didn't think he was as good as made out. But I think Saka, of the three options, I think is probably best option to hurting the Italians. I think he'll occupy them and he'll keep them busy. He'll keep them thinking. He'll keep them working with his constant industry. So, yeah, I'd lean towards Saka.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing how England get on with the challenge, probably the ultimate challenge, of dealing with that Italian defence. Basically, if you want a symbol of that defence and the Italian defensive culture, you see it in Giorgio Chiellini. you know, there's a wonderful, I don't think a player has ever been captured so well as when Morata talked about playing against him being like trying to take a banana off a gorilla in a cage. That is such a fantastic image. He's got that sheer joy of involvement. You know, we saw it in the bit of the mind games before the penalty shootout. How are they going to deal with him?
They're going to run at him. They're going to hope that hamstring that pinged earlier in the tournament will ping again. They're going to stretch him. Look, they won't be under any illusions. This Italian team has been behind for 10 minutes in their last 24 matches. I mean, it's an astonishing defensive record. But I think England's raw pace will give that Italian side a problem they haven't really faced that often in this tournament. England have the ability to pour at teams if they want to. I think it's great that Saka tires after 60 minutes, by the way, because then that gives you a chance to bring on a Grealish or a Foden or a Sancho. And I mean, and Sterling will keep running. Sterling will keep running throughout. I think it almost makes the manager's mind up for him that he needs to make that change at around the hour mark. I thought Saka was superb again last night. Just the way that he battles to free himself from a marker and retain possession and still then find that burst of pace to get away. I thought he was excellent off the flank. And I think if you get those guys running at that veteran Italian defence, there will be opportunities. Look, Italy are great. They've been fantastic throughout the tournament. They will be streetwise. They will be canny. They will cause England problems up front. Their midfield is superb. Verratti is such a good player. Locatelli's not even in their starting lineup now, having started the tournament on fire. They've got a lot going for them. But England have probably got the deepest squad in this tournament, all fit, all firing, all raring to go, each of them offering a slightly different threat. And combined, I wouldn't want to face this England team on Sunday.
I think a couple of things. On Chiellini, first of all, I think this is a really big game for Harry Kane. Now, Harry Kane has won a Golden Boot at a World Cup. He's won, I think, 4 out of 5 Golden Boots in the Premier League. It's an insane record. He's met up with and competed with centre-backs as good and better than Chiellini. So I don't want to praise this as he's, you know, this is the biggest defender he'll play against. But I think that, and I don't know how much this will play a role in his club decision career, if he can find a way to overcome Chiellini and really win another Golden Boot here and lead England to win this game, and win his first major trophy, I think that'd be significant because he's coming into this tournament now. It took him a while to wake up and there were doubts about whether he really was world-class, I was hearing from some people, because Golden Boots is one thing, but in the moments that really matter, Kane doesn't really get any team, be it Tottenham or England, over the line. This, I think, is his moment. I think he has to really find a way to draw out Chiellini in the way that he's been playing to enable the pacey players, as Dom mentions, to really hurt the Italian defence. Spinazzola, I think, is a massive loss for the Italians. That's a huge, I think, it was the best left-back of the tournament, even better than Luke Shaw. I think it's been brilliant. And for full disclosure, I tipped Italy to win the Euros before the Euro started, so it's a win-win for me, really, on Sunday, either way. But I think Italy have been brilliant. I think they have got a really good team, but I think, to Dom's point, I'm not sure they've got a great squad. So I think as long as England can deal with the occasion, get to the hour mark and still be within the game, if not ahead, I think I'm tipping England to slightly nudge this one.
Yeah, I suppose the one thing looking at Italy, they do have a feel of a bit of a club team. And, you know, we rightly hailed the culture that Southgate has ingrained, you know, within the England group. But let's, Dom, if we could, look at what Roberto Mancini has done with the Italians. There seems to me to be a perfect symmetry between the generations here. You've got Mancini and Vialli passing on all the old values to the current generation. You know, as fans, I think there's something special about seeing someone like Mancini, who we, you know, recognize as a player emerging as a coach of real stature. He, in his own way, has been as impressive as Southgate, hasn't he?
Yeah, it requires a context. It requires their failure to get to to the Russian World Cup. I mean, that sent such shockwaves through Italian football. For them to suddenly gone 33 games unbeaten, not having lost a game since September 2018, I think that is testament in itself to the job that Mancini has done with Vialli, with Lombardo involved as well, that Sampdoria link from back in the day. It's magnificent, everything they've achieved. And we look at the Italian team now, and on the one hand, they look like the Italian teams that we remember from years back. You know, they have that stinginess, the streetwiseness again. We keep going back to that. But they also have an added dimension. They're more expansive going forward. They're not cagey. They can run riot. They through the group stage, they were probably the most thrilling attacking team to watch, albeit they were dismissing teams of lesser quality themselves. But they've got everything. They're very well-rounded as a side. They've got very, very promising young players. They've got the older guys at the back. A bit like England in that respect. There's a balance there. And they've also got the likes of Jorginho playing and Verratti playing out their skin in midfield. And those guys are maybe, you know, in their mid-20s. They are the sort of experienced elder heads, but they're not veteran status yet. They've still got years ahead of them. So there is the perfect blend within the Azzurri squad. And I mean, let's not underestimate Mancini. We knew Mancini was a great coach. I mean, he performed miracles at Manchester City. I mean, he was the one who set the tone at City as a title winning team. So that shouldn't come as a great surprise. But the galvanizing effect that he's had on Italian football in raising his compatriots and restoring pride and taking them on to the next level, I think is quite something.
I think a couple of brief things. Sassuolo, I think I saw a stat, I should have double-checked this, that they are providing the most amount of players at this Euros than any other club. I have to double-check that. But it's definitely, I think, a handful, if not more, players. And for a club so small that I believe is in a part of Italy that was really ravaged with COVID cases when Italy was on fire with COVID a year ago, I think is a testament to how Italian national team has tapped into the work that Sassuolo are doing. And secondly, I think we're in for an exciting and arguably the best World Cup ever in 18 months' time. When I look at the Italian team and think where they'll be in 18 months, the English team in 18 months, the Spanish team, the Dutch team, the Portuguese team, the French team. There's going to be some really good teams with really good players in and around their peak years at the next major competition. So I look at the Italian team and think, and English team, even whoever loses on Sunday, they'll be thinking, one of you mentioned ahead of schedule, they'll be thinking, okay, we lost this final, but we're really going to put ourselves as contenders for the big one in 18 months' time. And I think both teams, both sides are have the squad, the manager and the age group, I believe, to really peak in 18 months' time in Qatar.
Yeah, I do see similarities between the teams on Sunday, even down to their backstories. You know, Dom, you know, with your Chelsea hat on, Jorginho, like Raheem Sterling, he's a story for our times, isn't he? You know, left Brazil to go to Italy at 15. He's exploited by an agent who left him to live on 20 euros a week. He wanted to quit. His mum talked him out of it. He fought his way up from Serie C. And as you said, you know, that midfield with Verratti and Barella is something else.
A story of our time, which also involves a haunted monastery, which is a slightly odd story of our time. But yeah, he lived in, apparently, when he arrived in Italy, that was where he had to stay initially as a kid. In the youth system of whichever club that he joined over there.
It's Napoli, wasn't it?
Is it Napoli? It was Napoli. Yeah. It's great. I like his story because he obviously established his reputation at Napoli under Maurizio Sarri, followed Sarri to England almost as part of that deal. Sarri was the add-on. I think a lot of Chelsea supporters doubted him, and there have been long periods where people have wondered why Jorginho is selected by Sarri in a struggling, well, it's not a struggling team, but a team that was unconvincing, by Lampard and subsequently, and to a certain extent by Tuchel. But actually, Jorginho has proved himself. He is he's integral. And I think what we don't see with him so much on the pitch, but we probably are starting to recognise now, is his influence. This is one of the more vocal members of the Chelsea squad in a language that isn't even his own. He is the life and soul, to a certain extent, of that squad and that team. The heartbeat in midfield, definitely. But around the place, he's the practical joker. He is the charismatic player in the midst of the group. And I think, given how young a lot of those Chelsea players are, that probably is quite significant. He's probably, weirdly, played a part in the continued development of some of the people he will come up against on Sunday at Wembley, and the Mason Mounts, and I don't know if Reece James ever gets onto the pitch. I mean, it's he has done remarkably well on the quiet almost. And the last month or so of his footballing career has been glittering. Champions League final and the coolness of that penalty the other night. You know, bedlam all around, and he still does his little hop, skip and jump as he comes up and converts that penalty. You just wonder whether he might produce that same hop, skip and jump as he goes and collects the Ballon d'Or in the next year.
I suppose it's time now just to get down to brass tacks. Simple question for both of you, please. Who wins on Sunday and why? Jordan.
Oh, man, the why is the harder than the actual who. So I tipped Italy before the tournament, and I have no issue in going against England if that's what I genuinely thought was going to happen. I'm going to go with England just. I've seen a more impressive England side at this tournament than I thought I would. I thought England would get to the semis, and that would be about it for them. I'm tipping England. Why? Oh, man. It just feels that everything is going in their favour. They've broken records, winning their first, you know, group game, first time winning 4-0, one goal conceded, the home advantage, the fan advantage, no injuries, no suspensions. You know, the Southgate doubters, some of whom have changed their mind. It just feels like it's all going so well for England. And maybe that's emotion. Maybe I've taken my analytical and pragmatic hat off. But I think my why is because it just feels like it's England's time. So I can't give any kind of more comprehensive, intelligent rationale beyond that. Apologies. But I'm going to go with England just because just.
Sounded intelligent to me, mate. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Dom.
Well, I'm not going to apologise for being emotional on it. England will win on Sunday.
I love that.
I was in Bloemfontein when we were humiliated by Germany. I was in Manaus when we lost in the opening group game in 2014. I was in Nice when they were humiliated by Iceland. I was in the Luzhniki in 2018 when they were beaten by the better team. They were overwhelmed. And I don't see those issues occurring with this England team. There's too much belief, there's too much conviction, and bottom line, there's too much quality. They've got a depth there that they've not had in generations. They've got a manager that knows how to manage and will get the best out of his players. And I don't, it won't be easy. It'll be an excruciating afternoon in so many ways. And the Italians are a wonderful, wonderful team, but England will win.
Just briefly to add to that, I think Dom's given me a good answer there now, so I'm going to kind of piggyback off his one. I think that England have... I don't think there's a capitulation on the cards. I think that if England go one, even two goals down, I don't think that's it. There's something about this England team that makes me think there's a belief there. And also, again, to one of Dom's earlier answers, I have faith in Southgate being able to tactically find the answer. So again, if England were to go 1-0 down or were to be overwhelmed, I have faith that Southgate in game now has definitely improved. I think one of the big failures, his biggest failure in Russia, was his in-game management. I have trust that if England are under the cosh, Southgate will find a way to tweak, and Steve Holland, to find a way to get England back into the game and get it done. It just feels like it's England's time to win. There you go.
Yeah, I suppose we should use the D word, shouldn't we? Destiny. You know, my scars go back to Mexico City in 86 to Italia 90. And you know, as Dom said, it has been a catalogue of almost predictable disappointment. We've said all along that this team and this squad is different, and it is different. I think, actually, the real signature achievement, and Jordan hinted at it earlier, will actually come at next year's World Cup. But, yeah, I expect them to give everyone, don't, whatever you do, wear a heart monitor on Sunday because it will explode. I think they'll win, and I hope they win. And I feel no shame in saying that I hope they win because they're such a likeable, significantly empathetic squad, or group of people, young people. And I think that's really important, the example they're setting. On that basis, I just want to make a heartfelt plea to the England fans who are going to be lucky enough to be at Wembley on Sunday. Please don't boo the national anthem, the Italian national anthem. It's beautiful and it should be respected. Don't get too high if England win or too low if they lose. It's what Gareth would want. In the meantime, thanks to Jordan and Dom for their insight and their faith, and to you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast. Enjoy the final.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.